Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 205, recorded June 22nd, 2015. The Rise and Fall of BlackBerry. Triangulation is brought to you by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you get award-winning financial tools, unbiased advice, and a transparent view of all your investments. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/triangulation. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. And by Credit Karma. With Credit Karma, you can learn your credit score, get tips and suggestions on managing your credit, and monitor your credit free. Visit creditkarma.com. And don't forget to download the app. Just text TWIT to 89800 to get started right away. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get some of the most interesting people in the world of tech into our studios to talk about what they know, and we learn, and I love it, and I'm glad you're here today because this actually is a story near and dear to my heart. The fall of RIM, BlackBerry, losing the signal, new book out, the untold story behind the extraordinary rise and spectacular fall of BlackBerry. One of its authors is here with us to talk about the book. Jackie McNish is a writer at the Globe and Mail in Toronto. Hi, Jackie. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing great. And you joined the story in progress, kind of, right? When did you start covering BlackBerry?
We, in 2013, were tasked with taking a look at what was Canada's global champion, Research in Motion, in the Waterloo area, just about an hour outside of Toronto, where I am right now. And, you know, the great mystery for a lot of people in the tech world was, how did something you love so much, which was the BlackBerry, end up falling apart so fast, so quickly, and so disastrously? And it took a long time for us to get to the bottom of. There's a team of us, and my colleague Sean Silkoff and I took a deep dive basically in about 2013. We wrote a story. We thought we had everything in the story, and it focused on their failure, sort of the pivotal point, their failure with a phone called the Storm. And that story...
Oh, God, that was a horrible phone.
It was a stinker of a phone. And that story went viral in a way that Canadian stories don't typically do. And Harry McCracken, who was then at Time, said, these guys should write a book. And the next thing, Sean and I were getting a call from American agent saying, Time magazine said, you guys should write a book. And how do you say no to that? So we ended up digging into it and learning a lot. And both Sean and I felt really lucky that we were able to get the access we did, not only to the two co-CEOs, Jim Balsillie and Mike Lazaridis, but over 120 Research in Motion, BlackBerry executives, suppliers, creative folks, early engineers, and it just ended up being such a rich, rich story.
No kidding. I mean, whew. I mean, I'm holding this is my last BlackBerry and my last phone before the iPhone came out in 2007, and I never looked back. And I think that anybody who's just kind of looking from a distance would say, well, that's what happened to BlackBerry. The iPhone happened to BlackBerry. It wasn't that complicated. Was there more to the story?
Yeah, it is. There is a lot more. And the story of BlackBerry, I think, will endure as a case study in business schools and in Silicon Valley, because this was the smartphone race really was little more than a decade, was one of the most disruptive, fastest technology races we've seen in our generation. We saw the smartphone go from zero in 1999 when BlackBerry introduced its first BlackBerry. We saw it go from zero to a market today where over a billion phones are sold annually every year. And that is, you know, little more than a decade. And in that period, BlackBerry topped Motorola, Nokia, a small company from above a bagel store in Waterloo, was able to do that because they had a piece of the internet in the phone, which was your email. And then Steve Jobs walked onto that stage in 2007 in San Francisco and said, waved that little glassy object and said, this is not just the internet. This right. is the whole Mac. We're putting it into the phone. And right. that was a game changer. But the story of Research in Motion's fall is more than just being out created, out disrupted by Apple and Google, which had Android as well, which would come shortly after. The mistake that they made that I think will be interesting for lots of folks in Silicon Valley is that they tried to beat Apple at its own game with the Storm, which we now know is a disaster. And at that point, this is a company that went from being an innovator to a follower. It did.
I remember my first BlackBerry. It was a pager, really, with a keyboard and a big honking thing. I remember having it, I think it was in 2000 or 2001. And not being able to get off of it.
it was addictive. That was the 950, and it looked like a little pager, yep. but it had a keyboard. And it was addictive because it was the first device that would not only effectively transported our emails from our computers, because that involved a lot of software, a lot of hardware to make it happen. And lots of folks were playing in that space, but they got it right because they were brilliant at compressing and conserving data on rickety networks. We all take what we get today from AT&T and Verizon for granted. But back in the late 90s, there were very few data networks. They were very rickety, and you couldn't survive unless you could compress data like Mike Lazaridis did with the 950 you're talking about. So they were smart about that, created their own internal network to make it work. And then their brilliance from a user point of view was the keyboard. It was so intuitive and so easy. You looked at other devices that were competing, and they created these tiny little keyboards. You had to have squirrel fingers to tap them. And Mike came up with the idea of opposable thumbs and made it so easy.
And the click scroll wheel was another brilliant innovation on the 950.
It was like a keyboard. You remember when you used your first IBM Selectric keyboard?
Yeah.
You love that clickety click.
Wow, this is great.
Yeah. And there it is, the 950.
Yep. Currently unavailable on Amazon.com.
I'm lucky enough to have one. I'll let you hold it.
But it won't work, right? Because the network no longer exists.
That's right. That was on the Mobitex network. It no longer exists.
Oh, man. It was so great. I remember in 2003, I think it was, interviewing the chairman of the FCC, Michael Powell at the time. And, man, he was on his 950 all the time. He was doing it. And I said, What is it about the BlackBerry that works for you, Michael? And he said, I do email triage. I don't really answer emails on here, but what I can do is I can go through my inbox and get rid of stuff and focus it so that when I get back to my desktop, I can really respond to it. And of course, by that time, everybody, I don't know how it was in Canada, but everybody in the U.S. government, every member of Congress, the president, and everybody else had BlackBerries.
And it was very smart. There's more to this story than technology, because a little company from Waterloo, how are they going to get the carriers
right.
on side to sell this to all of their customers? Well, they didn't. They sort of took responsibility for that themselves. They had these evangelists, these young kids from small town Ontario, would go on the road. They would go to the Microsoft conferences and other, you know, high profile technology conferences, and just walk through the halls and say, here, do you like this? You can have it for free. You know, it's like giving someone a puppy, saying you don't have to keep it if you don't want it, because once you got your hands on it, you would become immediately addicted to it. So it was word of mouth, and they specifically targeted people like the head of the FCC, CEOs, road warriors, salesmen that were out of the office all the time and hated being unconnected. And this brought them right back into either triage emails or other things going on in their life. Their wives could keep in touch with them. Families could keep in touch with them. It just gave them that instant gratification of communication that you couldn't get anywhere else.
In fact, it's completely counterintuitive to think that almost everybody in the United States government's email was going through Canada.
It wasn't, actually, because their relationship was with Bell South. They did have network operating centers, and initially they were in Waterloo, but they moved them subsequently to the States. Their big one now is in Atlanta. Bell South was their big backer in the United States, and they walked hand in hand in sort of creating the market through the upgrades on the network in Bell. And it didn't get to Congress right away. And the interesting thing is, the turning point for the politicians who now can't live without their smartphones was September 11. And we go right. into it in great detail in the book, because you'll recall that when the towers came down, we lost the cell towers. AT&T lost an exchange center, and the only thing working that day on Wall Street was the BlackBerry network, because they were using Bell South transmission towers that were based in New Jersey and were unharmed by the effects, the terrible effects that day. And there is a library, the Library of Congress has a collection of emails that were sent that day that are both heartbreaking and uplifting as people were finding each other or learning the terrible news of what had happened to their friends and family.
Yeah. Well, this is such a great story. And I want to talk about, of course, how they met. I want to talk about how clever they were in the beginning because, and this is a Canadian, this is a wonderful Canadian attribute, they downplayed what they were up to. They didn't get raise Microsoft's hackles by saying we're going to beat you. They said, "Oh no, it's just a pager. You don't have to worry about us." The book is called Losing the Signal. We're talking to Jackie McNish, one of the two authors, along with Sean Silkoff from the Globe and Mail in Toronto, and it almost is a Greek tragedy. It's what a story. And I can't wait to really dig more into it. We're going to take a little break and do that in a second. But first, a word from our friends at Personal Capital. This is one of my favorite triangulation interviews ever with Bill Harris. He was one of the founders of PayPal with Elon Musk. The stories he tells about the early days in PayPal. Then he went on to be CEO at Intuit. Guy knew money. Could have retired. Could have taken it easy for the rest of his life. He's a pilot. But no, he said, you know, there's something to be done here because people are not doing themselves any favors with the way they plan for their future, the way they plan for retirement. And he founded Personal Capital as a free solution to help you organize and understand your money. Look at that number. They're managing now $150 billion in assets. 800,000 people, including me, are using the Personal Capital dashboard to basically understand where our money is, what it's doing, and to find the things that are costing. Things like hidden broker fees. Those brokers, they're not, you know, they're salesmen. They're not working for you. They're working to make money. To find out where the mutual fund and 401k fees are just slicing years off your retirement. And this is, by the way, all free when you go to personalcapital.com/triangulation. Free. I'll explain how it works. It's a really freemium because ultimately, if you want, they will manage your portfolio, and that's where they make money. The dashboard's free forever, and you've got to try this. It's available on desktop, on every mobile phone, on tablets, and yes, Android Wear, and now the new Apple Watch. And I love it because I get alerts on my watch saying, hey, you want to pay attention to this. You're out of balance. You got too many bonds. You got too many. And it's so great. It's so great. Now, here's the deal. If you go there right now, personalcapital.com/triangulation, and you sign up, you put in your accounts, completely safe, by the way, secure. You can, if you put in $100,000 or more in assets, you don't have to, but if you do, you can get a free 30-minute review. This is not a sales pitch. This is a 30-minute review with Personal Capital's financial advisors. These folks are not brokers. They're not salespeople. They have a fiduciary responsibility to look out for your best interest. There are no commissions. This is a completely fee-based service, and they waive the fee on this primary, on this beginning call, which is, for many of us, all you really need. You can talk about your financial goals, your risk tolerance, the time horizon you have for retirement. So get your plan together. Get it started right. And if you've been investing, you know, if you've been a smart young person putting money away in your 20s, you've probably got a decent little nest egg. But you want to make sure you keep track of it, and that's what Personal Capital helps you do. Right now, personalcapital.com/triangulation. Set it up. It's quick. It's easy. You'll have that dashboard forever. If you want the 30-minute review, all you have to do is put $100,000 or more in assets in there. And, of course, they do have portfolio management. But there's no obligation. They're not going to harass you on that one. Personalcapital.com. No reason not to do it. /triangulation. That's a good line there on the website. Your portfolio deserves a second opinion. Maybe even a first opinion would be good. PersonalCapital.com/triangulation. The book is Losing the Signal. Just came out from Flatiron Books. You'll see it at Amazon. I think there's an audiobook version of this, isn't there?
That's correct.
Yeah, I think I saw it on Audible. Jackie McNish is our guest. She's the author, along with her colleague at the Globe and Mail in Toronto, Sean Silkoff. So they were, you know, this is actually, I think their Canadian heritage leads to this. they were very unassuming when they first encountered Microsoft and all this.
Absolutely. This is a story of two very different people. I mean, it's not unusual to have an innovator like Mike Lazaridis team up with a businessman like Jim Balsillie. We saw that at Palm. We've seen Mr. Hewlett and Mr. Packard.
Sure.
But this one must rank as the most extraordinarily odd coupling of two executives. On the one hand, you've got Mike Lazaridis, who from the age of five was making record players out of Lego systems that produced a little sound, not a lot, but he was very interested in combining the power of radio waves, wireless technology, and computing. I mean, this was a boy who was in his parents' basement tinkering since he was very young and went to the University of Waterloo, got a degree in engineering, most of a degree. He got so hooked on pursuing his ideas, he didn't quite finish it at the end. And he started his little company above the bagel store, as I said, with a bunch of a ragtag group of engineers that went in pursuit of wireless technology, creating these modems. And along comes Jim Balsillie, who's from a small town in Peterborough, Ontario. He is on a mission to become the Canadian elite establishment. He goes to Trinity School. He's an accountant at Clarkson Gordon, gets his Harvard MBA, and decides that technology is the key for getting ahead in what is a very clubby business community here in Canada. It's through technology you can break down walls. He shows up at Research in Motion. The two men are so different to this day, they can't agree exactly about how they met. But the story goes that Jim walks in, tries to squeeze Mike as a supplier to get a better cost, and Mike looks at him and says, "I need you." And it's a great story. We tell it in the book. Mike Lazaridis says, I'll let you be my partner, but you got to meet my fiance, Ophelia, who became his wife. She meets Jim. She leaves the meeting with Mike and says, "He's a shark." And Mike says, "Yeah, but he's going to be my shark." And that's what I need to make a go of this, because they were living hand to mouth after almost 10 years in business. Great ideas, but getting squeezed by everyone. And the two of them settled on wireless communicator devices as the future, because they felt that they were never going to make it as a supplier of modems. They had to have something unique that you had to have, because someone was always going to be a better low-cost producer. So they focused on what became the Interactive 950 that you remember having in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. and proceeded very carefully. Mike Lazaridis is an open engineer who believes in sharing and was constantly sharing ideas with people. Intel created a chip for them that was just the right size for their first BlackBerry. But Jim believed that only the paranoid survived. He thought that they would be killed by Silicon Valley. It was a matter of time. So he believed in being very secretive and very cunning about how he negotiated contracts, how he introduced new products, and how he sold them down the road. Very different couple. Very interesting, fascinating pairing of two men.
But as you say, that's really common in Silicon Valley. You need a shark. Especially
Absolutely.
If you're, like Lazaridis, like Steve Wozniak, kind of this genial engineer type, and the engineers want to give away the store.
That's right. And easy to take advantage of them, and that's what was happening with Mike. I think Jim got into the partnership by basically mortgaging his house.
Wow.
And a few days after the money went into the company, he went to go check on it and saw that it had all been spent.
Oh, jeez.
They had all these debts. So it was a tough existence, and Jim gets enormous credit for beating the big U.S. American carriers, Bell South and Ram Mobile Data, which was ultimately bought by Bell South, really squeezed them hard to get. They wanted to sell that first Interactive 950 for a very low price, which would have meant that Research in Motion wouldn't make money. And Jim danced around them, got a competing contract from someone else, drove Bell South folks crazy. But it's what he felt he needed to do to survive and to stay ahead of people with much more leverage than he had.
Yeah, that's the counter to the Microsoft story. They knew when to put the pedal to the metal, when they needed to play hard, as they did with Bell South, and they knew when they needed to back off and say, "Oh, no, we're not going to harm your business." They actually were very smart, the two of them, a good team.
They were, and they were widely respected. Jim was very controversial because of all his tactics. He really is quite extraordinary how he hustled for that company. He was their chief salesman. We've got a great story in the early 2000s when he was trying to hook up with the European carriers and they weren't paying much attention to this little company from Waterloo. And he was in Cannes for the annual conference of the carriers, the mobile carriers. And he wasn't having any success getting to speak to anyone at a cocktail party. ends up in an empty dining room in a big ballroom, walks up and sees the head table and sees all the names of the top CEOs of the European carriers, and takes out his business card, folds it on the reverse side, looks at the calligraphy on the name tags, tries to do a variation of it with his own name, puts it down, calls a waiter over and says, "You need another chair here." And that's how Jim Balsillie got to the table with the big carriers.
Isn't that great? He was also sly. You tell the story of how he kind of tricked the CEO of Palm, Jim Jankowski. Was it Jim? Jim Jankowski. Carl Jankowski, that's right. By pretending they were going to move to another network, tricking him.
Yes, they tricked him, but I think Carl was one of the great tricksters of all time. They both say they'd never met anyone like him because Jim might say, you know, "I just bought, a certain kind of a car." And Carl would say, "Oh, I've got two of those." And Jim would say, "I play a lot of hockey. I played in the school team." And Carl would say, "Oh, well, you know what? I was in the Olympics." And then Jim would say, "Well, I got 3 gold medals in the Olympics in hockey." And none of it was true. But he was just, he was just unstoppable in the bragging. And they played him along like a fish on a line. And Palm very much wanted to buy Research in Motion. And they played him along and then left him. And they would say that that's what they did to keep him off his game, to prevent him from out-muscling them and taking them over. And I imagine that Carl would feel very much that he'd been hard done by, played around. But Jim would say to this day, that's what he had to do to survive.
That's a great moment in this book when they're sitting down at dinner and just, I mean, when Jankowski discovered the RIM executives flew in a Westwind jet, Jankowski declared he was certified to pilot dozens of planes. When the Palm CEO inquired about Lazaridis' impressive home theater, Jankowski bragged about his $250,000 Nantucket home stereo system, custom built by Sony engineers. Learning that Lazaridis drove a new BMW M5, Jankowski leaned in, "Mike, I have an M6. But then they finally get to lying about Olympic medals. I mean, my God.
Well, they called him the topper because nothing they could say would not be topped by Jankowski. And it was really quite something. He had a short career at Palm
in
the end.
Yes, he did. And in fact, while he's busy topping them, they're busy outsmarting him. So I think maybe he was focusing on the wrong thing. It's really a fun story, but it is a tragedy in the end. And we're talking, when did they decide to do phones? Because it was really kind of a pager system at first.
I think that carriers pushed for that initially. And they, Mike was all about data and compression.
Right.
He didn't want to do anything that would burden the networks. So I think that the marketing folks pushed that, Jim pushed that, the carriers and the customers. The customers didn't want to carry around 2 devices, and Mike came around pretty quickly realizing that that's what they needed to do. It meant, new systems, new operating systems, new software, different designs, but they did it brilliantly. Their BlackBerry was just as effective as a phone as it was as a sort of a data text pager over emails. And, once that happened is when it really started to take off in the sort of around 2003, 2004.
And yet there was a freight train coming down the tunnel, Adam. We're going to talk about how their fortunes turned in just a little bit. Our guest is the author of a new book called Losing the Signal, the untold story behind the extraordinary rise and spectacular fall of BlackBerry. It does begin at the beginning. We're kind of moving to the middle now. Jackie McNish is with us, her co-author, Sean Silkoff. And it really is a fun read, especially for those of us who had BlackBerries and were watching from the outside. And as you get towards the end of the story, you really start to wonder, what is going on up there in Waterloo? We'll talk about it in just a second. And, the storm. Mm-hmm. My wife had a storm. I think she sort of inadvertently left it on the top of the car and drove off. And that was the end of that. Our show today Our show today brought to you by Blue Apron. We love the Blue Apron. We use the Blue Apron. We cook the Blue Apron. I hope you do, too. You know, I think cooking is great. For a while, we thought we were going to be a fast food nation, right? Nobody would ever cook. Everybody'd everything out of a can or a microwave oven, a TV dinner, go to the restaurants, go to the fast food joints. And I think in the last few years, we've rediscovered good food, well-prepared. The problem is, who has the time? Blue Apron solves this conundrum. It's a better way to cook because you don't have to shop. You get home from work, and there's your lovely refrigerated Blue Apron box filled with delicious, fresh ingredients, just the right amount for your dinner. Here's Jason's box. He's going to make a lovely dinner right here. You see how easy it is. And this is a no-compromise dinner, a great value, easy to prepare, about half an hour, healthy, between 500 and 700 calories per serving for less than $10 a meal. They also have a family plan with kid-friendly ingredients, so your whole family could enjoy this. Notice, by the way, the fish, the meat, never frozen. It's refrigerated in the box. And by the way, they work with your schedule, so you don't ever have a box sitting on the stoop waiting for you. It's always there when it's supposed to be there. They also will work around your dietary preferences. Now, in there is that great recipe card. It's a full 8.5 by 11 glossy laminated card with pictures, illustrations. They have additional videos on their website. In fact, all these recipes are freely available on their website at blueapron.com/twit. So if you want to do the shopping, you can, but Blue Apron makes it so you don't have to. And, man, guys, you want to impress your date on date night? Make an amazing meal, and there's no one who won't say, wow. You're a catch. And it's easy. And once you've made it, by the way, you can make it again because now you know the way. You've been led down the path by the great chefs at Blue Apron. The menus are always new and fresh. You'll never get the same meal twice. You're going to love it. Shipping is free. And you will be blown away by the quality and the freshness. They always get their ingredients from local farms. My mouth's watering right now looking at this amazing meal Jason's making. Watch this. He's getting the tahini. He's making the falafels. This is Jason Howell.
We remade this recipe a
Master
week ago.
Chef.
And yeah, it's pretty
See,
awesome.
Now that you've done it, you can go out and you get the ingredients and you know how to do it.
That's right.
So it's kind of like, I mean, the reason they call it Blue Apron, that's the blue aprons that are worn by the apprentice chefs at the Cordon Bleu in France. So in a way, they don't call it a cooking school, but you really do learn. And it's fun. And get the whole family involved. We're going to get you two meals for free so you can see how this works at blueapron.com/twit. This week's menu is up. You can see what they've got on the menu. Get your first two meals free. Blue Apron. Oh, man. Crispy fried chicken. New England style shrimp rolls. Black bean and quinoa enchiladas. Fried green tomato burgers. What? They have vegetarian. Yeah, you bet. We sent Mary Jo Foley. Loved it. She's a veggie. blueapron.com/twit. Two meals free waiting for you. We're talking about the spectacular rise and fall of BlackBerry. And, you know, anybody who used a BlackBerry loved the BlackBerry. I mean, the passion people felt for BlackBerry. Even for my last BlackBerry, the Curve. I loved it. The keyboard. People still talk nostalgically about that. But along comes Apple in 2007, and they've got multi-touch. There's no physical keyboard. Steve Jobs made a big point about that. You don't need a physical keyboard because it's all on the screen. In fact, really, if you look at it, the BlackBerry product was more mature, had better app store, had better selection. In every way, was a better product. But Apple captured the imagination of people. The real question is, what did Mike and Jim see this coming? Why didn't they see this coming? And why didn't they respond?
You know, that is the big question. And I think the narrative up until now, particularly in the U.S. and Silicon Valley, is they were idiots. They were complacent.
Right.
They were arrogant.
Right.
They didn't get the significance of the iPhone. That's not true. Mike Lazaridis took it apart in his home as soon as it hit the market and said, oh, my God, they put a Mac in this thing. And Mike Lazaridis' perspective, you have to understand, is informed by his early fight to get the BlackBerry on very primitive networks, the fights that they had with Bell South to get more apps, to do everything they wanted. He was all about compression and conservation, and that's the traditional engineering approach.
Well, especially from where he was coming from.
Absolutely.
You know, you look at WAS, same thing. How can I take four more chips out of this controller? Because resources were very expensive and very constrained, and nobody imagined a day where these resources weren't.
And he looked at this and said, this will never work.
Right.
And you know what? For a year, he was right. We all remember those dropped calls, mm-hmm. all the networks crashing. Mm-hmm. What he didn't understand was that the key to Apple's and the iPhone's success was their multi-year contract with AT&T. AT&T's executive was on that stage with Steve Jobs announcing this unique contract. And that exclusive agreement gave them the incentive to invest billions of dollars in their networks to upgrade it. It took a year, took a couple of years, and there were a lot of drop calls, a lot of frustrations, lawsuits over how these phones didn't work properly. And then it was all go. It was the Jesus phone. Remember that name? Everyone
yes.
was just gaga for the phone. And Mike and his engineers didn't understand that the world had changed, not so much because it was a touchscreen glass phone with a browser and internet access. It was because the networks were changing as well, and they had a competitive contract that they couldn't match. And so what did they do? Verizon approached them secretly. They wanted an iPhone killer. And Mike Lazaridis went to a meeting in New Jersey with the senior people at Verizon and said, I've got the phone for you. It's the Bold, which would prove to be their technically most successful phone of all times. Mm-hmm. But they didn't want anything to do with that. They wanted a touchscreen phone. And so Research in Motion, I mean, think about it. They're looking at one of the biggest carriers in North America saying, we will give you, you know, an exclusive deal here. We'll put your phone in all of our stores. They never had access to that kind of a consumer-oriented carrier before. So it was the opportunity of a lifetime. Do you say, no, we're a keyboard maker. We can't do that. Verizon said, you do this in 9 months, and we'll give you this deal. It took them more than 9 months. It took them almost a year and a half. And by 2009, just before Thanksgiving, they shipped a product that in all respects they knew was a failure. They just couldn't do it in that short a period of time. So what was the lesson? That you can't follow, that you say no to a contract like that? Easy for us to say. I don't know that the right answer is, but it seems to me it's a pretty convincing case that you should have given it a try. Execution, complete failure.
Yeah, it had a screen that clicked physically.
Yeah, it did.
Clicked.
And that was Mike's idea because he couldn't imagine people using a smartphone without that click. If it wasn't the keyboard, do you replicate the click? And that was the click worked on this sort of little dome hidden underneath the screen. And if you pressed down a letter, you would get that click. But the problem was the balance. And they'd created these products that were handmade in Waterloo that worked brilliantly. But once it moved into mass manufacturing, they just couldn't replicate that careful balance that you needed to make the dome move the keyboard in the right way.
You got to set the stage, though, because they were on top of the world in 2008. $70 billion stock market value. Quarterly revenues had doubled year over year. They were selling 60,000 BlackBerries a day. They had 45% of the market in the United States. I mean, this is as dominant a phone, a device, as there had ever been.
Right. And at that point, it's important to remember the BlackBerry is not even 10 years old at this point. So they are dealing with two things. They've got Silicon Valley. They've got Apple, and they've got Google, who's trying something totally different. And, you know, in the end, you could argue was the most successful strategy, giving up their Android software to free to manufacturers and creating an opportunity for Samsung and others to race into this market. And they, at the time, they were facing the greatest competitive threat of their short life as a BlackBerry maker. They were racing to keep up, to scale, to keep up with global demand. They were a $20 billion company. They were moving from one manufacturing site in Waterloo to another three or four in other locations around the world. Indonesia couldn't get phones fast enough. One of the largest, most populous countries in the world was just crazy for this phone. So while they seemed to be having their greatest success, the roots underneath this company were starting to disintegrate because they couldn't do both. They couldn't be smart about how they were going to compete with Silicon Valley at the same time. They were so successful in trying to keep up with demand.
There were some people who saw the problem ahead. You quote Strombo, George Strombolopoulos, very popular host in Canada, in 2008, in April 2008, telling Rim what are you going to do if this, do you ever look at it and go, what are we going to do if this isn't our primary business, growing Rim beyond a BlackBerry? And Jim laughs, and says, no, we're a very poorly diversified portfolio. You're just going to focus on one thing, Strombo says? It either goes to the moon or crashes to the earth.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Message to self. Don't say that.
Yikes.
In a television interview.
You also say something very telling, because you say when Jobs promoted the iPhone, he would talk about the experience. He would talk about searching Paris maps or listening to Bob Dylan. And Lazaridis would say, well, it's a 3G tri-band, HSDPA, quad-band, edge, Wi-Fi, A, B, and G, GPS device, 624 megahertz, strong-armed with an MMX. And he would engineer it. But he's a geek, right? Of course he is. And there, people watching, I'm going, oh, yeah, well, yeah. But it turned out, really, in some ways, this was a change in the culture. That these devices were owned for a long time by people like me who cared about that kind of stuff. And Jobs made it about the experience.
Right. When you had a BlackBerry, you put it on a belt, on a little container on your belt.
Yeah.
I mean, you were the ultimate nerd, right? You know,
nerdy.
And you didn't care how it looked. You didn't care that it was beautiful or that it wasn't beautiful or that it wasn't fun. I mean, the iPhone was fun. And Apple had the great advantage of Steve Jobs, who from the beginning with his first Mac computers gave you something that was a thing of beauty, that was easy to use, intuitive, and fun. And you've absolutely nailed one of the key issues here for this company. Neither Jim or Mike were communicators. Jim, when he likes to go unprepared before he gives a speech, and then when you go unprepared to give a speech, mm-hmm. you end up getting derailed pretty quickly, and the message gets very confused. Mike loved to celebrate the intricate technical details. He sounded like a product manual because he thought that's what people wanted to hear. And they had a problem because they had grown up, you know, as slaves to the carriers. And a lot of people will say, and I think they're right, that RIM didn't understand who its customers were. For a long time, they felt their customers were the carriers. Steve Jobs, remember, used to call them the four orifices. You couldn't do anything without their approval. And BlackBerry would try to do simple apps like contacts or calendars, and the carriers would say no. So they would sneak them in, and they would have them embedded in the BlackBerries, and then they would do a software upgrade, and then the lights would go on in the networks because all this capacity was being used because these apps, these stealth apps, had been lit up by BlackBerry. Steve Jobs had nothing to do with that. With that special contract with AT&T, he was able to do an end run on the things that were making it difficult for Research in Motion to innovate in areas like apps that Apple was so good at.
And as often, I mean, they were very bullish on the Storm. The Storm obviously was a flop and a black mark on BlackBerry and Verizon, too. Thanks, guys, for forcing that down our throats. But that also started to shatter their relationship. I mean, and that's often the case. When times are tough, it sometimes is hard. And they didn't get along too well as time went by.
This is where the story does become very Shakespearean. And it's very sad. And it's one that it's still hard for a lot of people to focus on because it ended so badly. And part of it was the Storm. When you're Jim the salesman and you're Mike the innovator, and the innovator is delivering a product that the customers don't want, that opens up a gulf. The gulf got ripped even further apart by the scandal involving backdating of stock options, which is a scandal that's well known in the United States, and it happened at Research in Motion. They were personally held liable, paid millions of dollars. Jim.
Meanwhile, Steve Jobs just skates off unscathed.
Yeah, he did, but a couple of his lawyers took the bullet.
Yeah.
But what happened with BlackBerry was that Mike very much felt that finance was Jim's business. He didn't pay attention to it. Jim should have done a better job of protecting them from it, and he felt betrayed. That's in his words. And Jim himself felt betrayed that Mike would even think that, because Jim had done so much for the company. Helped them. I haven't even mentioned the patent fight that they had with NTP and how Mike, that caused a real crisis for Jim. And so there was a lot of these tensions erupted. The stock options was the last blow. They had a very difficult series of conversations. They maintained their professional relationship, but anyone working in the organization at the senior level knew that mom and dad weren't speaking to each other anymore, that it was a marriage in name only.
The wheels are starting to fall off, basically.
Absolutely. This is the train is, the derailment is slowly happening. And when you have the two heads of the company not speaking to each other, able to make decisions, and the individual camps are growing and separating and rivalries are occurring within the organization, you no longer know what you should be making, how you should be positioning it, how you should be even marketing it. When their next big disaster was the playbook, Mike to this day feels that their tablet, the playbook, was a very smart step for the company. It didn't have native email, but he defends it to this day because he says all you have to do is tether your BlackBerry and you only need one plan.
I remember very well seeing the playbook at CES and saying, where the hell's the email?
You weren't the only one. Yeah. A lot of people are asking that question. And there's Mike, the traditional engineer, the conservationist, thinking what a waste it would be to have two plans. Again, misunderstanding the consumers. And at that point, they really fell apart. The board was coming under increased pressure. There was new directors coming in. That was a third camp. So you have the board, the two CEOs at odds. And the rest is just a very sad story of a company falling apart. And I'll tell you a little anecdote. Samuel Clemens, who we know as Mark Twain, he made a very bad investment in the 1800s in a printing press. And there was a lot of competition, very, very similar parallels to the smartphone world, a lot of innovations. He was left behind. He was forced into bankruptcy. And someone asked him, how did your business fall apart? And he said, at first it was very slow, and then it was very fast. And that is exactly the story of BlackBerry.
We're going to take a break and talk a little bit about what's going on today at BlackBerry, because it's not all over yet, I don't think, I hope. The author, of course, of Losing the Signal, The Untold Story Behind the Extraordinary Rise and Spectacular Fall of BlackBerry, Jackie McNish is with us. And it is a great story. Well, and by the way, I have to say, very well researched, great detail, stuff you've never read before. That really gives you some insight. And I think you're exactly right, Jackie. It's very easy for those of us on the outside to say, well, Jim and Mike were just dumb. They ended up fighting too much. They created bad products. And they didn't think ahead. They didn't see the disruption coming down the pipe. But, it's easy in hindsight to say, oh, well, the iPhone was coming on strong. Not so easy when you're in the middle of it to know what to do. We'll take a break. Come back with more in just a bit. Our sponsor today is Credit Karma. And, a couple of weeks ago in Triangulation, I said something wrong, and I want to correct that. Credit Karma does require your Social Security number to sign up. I had said it does not. It does. Of course, you don't have to give them any credit card information because it's free. Credit Karma is fantastic. I've been using it for a long time. They have an app now, which is great. The most important number in your life, it's not your age, it's not your IQ, it's your credit score. And it will tell you what you're going to pay on credit card interest, what your home loan's going to be, whether you can even buy a home or an auto, what your student debt's going to look like. It is crucial to know it and understand it and how it got there and where it's going, and that's why Credit Karma is so great. Credit Karma, you may see other places say free credit score. Mm-mm. Credit Karma's the place to get your free, and I mean free, there are no strings attached, credit scores, reports, and monitoring, and great financial tools to help you make sense of your credit. I'll never forget when I signed up for Credit Karma and immediately saw that I still had an outstanding credit card that I thought was long gone and an outstanding payment on there. I called the company, resolved it, and my credit score went up, and it's worth just to find out what's going on. Download the free Credit Karma app. Easy to do. Just text TWIT to 89800. That's a short code. In most cases, that's a free text. TWIT to 89800. You'll get a link to the app and suggestions to help you manage and monitor your credit. Be alerted, which is nice when your credit score changes. That's really nice, because this otherwise is happening all behind the scenes. You don't know what's going on. Credit Karma has financial tools to help you calculate home affordability, debt repayment, simple loans, and amortization. Really useful site. Lots of articles on there to help you understand your credit, why it is the way it is, what you can do to know it, to protect it, to find the best deals. I love Credit Karma. And this is, again, absolutely free. So I want to be clear. I misstated. They do need your Social Security number. That's how they're going to get your credit information to sign up, but you don't give them any credit card information because this is absolutely free. CreditKarma.com to manage and monitor your credit for free. No credit card required. Do download the free app too. Text TWIT to 89800 to monitor your credit on the go. I love it. CreditKarma.com. We're talking to Jackie McNish. Her book, Losing the Signal, she wrote it. I got to give credit to Sean Silkoff, her colleague at the Globe and Mail in Toronto. And I think Canadians particularly, we were talking about Matthew Ingram, who we know, of course, very well, Harry McCracken as well. But Matthew and I think all Canadians really thought of research in motion as their shining example that it doesn't all happen in Silicon Valley. It can happen over a bagel store in Waterloo. And that was great. And so I have to think, you can tell me, there's a little bit of sadness about what happened to BlackBerry among Canadians.
Oh, there's more than a little bit of sadness. This is like the hockey team that won the Stanley Cup 6 years in a row and then lost. And they went from being superheroes to bums. But both Sean and I feel very strongly that there is a lot of success to be told here, and that what Research in Motion's lasting legacy is, they showed Canada, and there's a world of startup entrepreneurs out in Canada now.
Yeah.
They showed Canada that you can go from zero to $20 billion in less than 10 years. It's possible. And you don't have to be from Silicon Valley. You can be from Waterloo. You can be from above a bagel store. And you can create something like this that changes how we communicate.
Yeah. 2009, they did something interesting. This is right at their peak when they've got 20,000 employees and the iPhone hasn't yet eaten them alive. They acquired QNX, a company they still own. And, you know, in many ways, that could end up being the gem in BlackBerry's crown.
Absolutely. That's the sleeper card for them, because they are really, really good in the business of operating systems. They've done it for nuclear power plants. They do it for information systems in cars now. You know, the future is clearly software. It's no longer hardware, handsets for Research in Motion, or any smartphone maker. The future will be software, the apps, the different connections you can make to the internet and to the things in your home and your car. That is the future. If QNX can't do it, then it's hard to believe that anyone else can.
Yeah.
And Research in Motion right now, BlackBerry as it's known now, is keeping that all under a very tight lid. We don't know where they're going to take QNX, but that is the wing you want to watch.
Absolutely. So when did Jim and Mike realize it was time for them to go? Because they really hung on for a long time.
They did. And there's two points I would make about the length of their staying at the company. The board really could have moved more quickly to change the leadership. It was badly in need of change. There was no successors. That's bad on Mike and Jim, bad on the board for not having plan B and a C. This company totally depended on its founders, which, as we know in Silicon Valley and the technology sector, is not always the best option. Sometimes you have to be ruthless and cannibalize that great product that you made so you can pivot and turn another direction. And their pivots were not successful. They clearly needed new leadership. They decided both to go at different times. Jim first, because he backed the idea of software and instant messaging. BBM, one of their other great inventions, was the early iteration in many ways of what we now take for granted, such as WhatsApp and all the other instant messaging. Yeah. He really thought that that's where the company had to go, but he no longer had the support of the board at that point.
Yeah, in fact, they did, you know, kind of try to release BBM cross-platform, made a big deal about it, and I think it went down without a trace.
Yeah, it just didn't happen.
Yeah.
Could have been, would have been, might have been a good idea.
Yeah. Is it that Balzilli kind of dominated the board of directors, that really wasn't an independent board, that Jim kind of managed it?
He managed it very well for a long time. I mean, think of a CEO walking into a board today and saying, we've just negotiated this deal. We'd like to announce it tomorrow. We're taking over this company. Sign here. And the board did. I mean, it just breaks all the rules that we understand today in modern corporate governance.
So many mistakes. I mean, you got your patent problems. You got your options scandal. You got a board that isn't really independent. And then, of course, you get hit with a far better product that nobody saw coming, the iPhone. You can't respond to it very well. In fact, you choose to respond to it based on what Verizon wanted. Always a mistake. Ultimately, Jim and Mike have to step down. Where did the new CEO come from?
The ultimately, Mike Lazaridis won the succession battle because he had one of his engineers, Torsten Hines, named to replace him because he was a device man, and Mike didn't believe that software was the future. He believed that, you know, the BlackBerry had to carry on. It would be new iterations. And so Torsten Hines was plunked into a very difficult position in 2013 to try and create, you know, a new future for the company that was very much the same old future. He doubled down with another Apple iPhone competitor. It was the Z10, very ill-fated phone that nobody was really interested in. It was too clunky. The operating system had its problems. And he lasted less than a year in the company.
He's now running PowerMat. And so then John Chen comes along. Where did Chen come from?
Chen comes from Silicon Valley. His background, he was known for resurrecting Sybase, a company with a lot of similar type of issues. And he was brought in by new shareholders, Fairfax Financial, headed by Prem Watsa, one of our most respected sort of contrarian value investors here in Canada. They're also backed by PrimeCap out of California. So they very much are benefiting from long-term shareholders who are interested in a long-term game here. I mean, things were pretty rough in 2013. It looked like this company might just spiral out of control. And I will tip my hat to Mike and Jim at this point. Jim was a very conservative financier. There was no debt at this company, billions of dollars of cash, which allowed them to buy time. And Mike Lazaridis had enough innovation left in the cupboard. Both the Passport and the Classic, which I have, are iterations of phones that he designed and planned before he left. So I think the company has played out a waiting game to get the company downsized and refocused. The next step for this company is, where are you going to go?
Yeah, I mean, at one point it looked like it was going to be sold off for parts.
Absolutely. It was looking very rough.
Yeah. So it's somewhat encouraging. I don't know how well the new phones are selling. There's certainly people like you who are fans of the old BlackBerry feel very at home with the Classic. The Passport, kind of a weird shape. I'm not sure how well that's sold, but the Classic, I think, is doing well among BlackBerry fans.
Yeah, it's doing very well, but it's this company is not going to survive by continuing to make phones.
No.
Its revenues are declining. Its income from even handsets themselves are a smaller and smaller portion of their total revenues.
So what do you see happening to BlackBerry over the next few years?
I think ultimately we will see them partner up. And I think that the focus for this company and its future is on enterprise. The enterprise servers, the enterprise packaging that they bring to corporate clients. We do care about security today. We do worry about hacking. You remember when Sony was hacked? The executives went down to the basement to get their old BlackBerries because they're encrypted messaging system.
Right.
You know, it's still worth something today. So I think that that's important. And you could ask yourself, who out there is weak in enterprise that needs to bolster that? Samsung is a potential partner. They're already partnering up on some aspects of the enterprise system. So I would watch that evolving relationship. That could be a very interesting future for the company.
And there have been rumors that they might abandon their OS and turn to Android. That seems like kind of a Me Too strategy. I don't know how well that will do.
I don't know enough about the current status of the operating system to give you a smart answer to that.
Yeah.
I know that there are enough BlackBerry people that are already offended at the very idea. But sometimes you have to do what you have to do to survive.
Yeah.
So I'm not too sure if it will be a combination of a QNX type system along with Samsung's. Is definitely a better system than the one they have now.
I noticed you carried both an iPhone and a BlackBerry. But do you like BlackBerry 10? Do you like your Classic?
I like my Classic. I think it's a much better operating system, a much better browser, but it's still not perfect. The iPhone is a much better browser on the internet, and your ability to read documents and scan documents is just, you know, you can't compare it to what the BlackBerry is offering. It's much clunkier.
I've been so tempted. I've had my finger has hovered over the buy button on a Classic for some time. They're not very expensive. You can get them on Amazon for about $320.
If you love the keyboard, it's the one to get. I love a keyboard. I write on my phone. It just is just there's nothing like it.
It's so tempting. Hey, Jackie, this is great. It was a trip. Not only a trip down memory lane, but also kind of an aha. Oh, that's why they. Oh. Now, so and in the long run, I think it's somewhat exculpatory. It tells the story of two guys who had their flaws but did the best they could in a rapidly changing environment. It's, as you say, Shakespearean, a kind of a tragedy in the long run, but maybe a tragedy that'll be more like one of those MTV Behind the Music stories where they had their up, their down, but then they came back at the end. I'm hoping, I'm rooting for BlackBerry. Losing the Signal is the new book. We've been talking to Jackie McNish, the author, along with Sean Silkoff, the untold story behind the extraordinary rise and spectacular fall of BlackBerry. Thank you, Jackie.
My pleasure. Good talking to you.
Appreciate your time. Good to talk to you, too. So close to buying that classic. I'm really, yeah, it's so tempting. Wouldn't it be fun to have that? We do Triangulation every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time. That's 1800 UTC. If you want to watch live, I appreciate it. We love the chat room. Some great side conversations going on in the chat room. And, of course, I use that input to do the show. But if you can't watch live, we've got it for you on demand, twit.tv/TRI. That's for every show, all 100, whatever it is, shows that we've done. But you can also get and subscribe every week, and I think that's a good way to do it, in your favorite podcast app on your BlackBerry, your smartphone, your iPhone, your Android phone, whatever it is you have on desktop as well. I would appreciate it if you subscribe. That way you won't miss one. And I'll tell you what, this is one of those shows you really don't want to miss. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.